Okay, let's get started. My name is John Beck, and it's my pleasure to co-direct with Kurt Dewhurst here at the museum our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, which for nearly 20 years now here at Michigan State has endeavored to look at the intersection of culture and work, broadly defined. So we're very glad that you're here for this brown bag. We're in the 17th year of our brown bag series, and the 18th year is pretty much almost put to bed in terms of next year's schedule. We have two more brown bags this April, and I'll hand out those and then make a couple of other announcements and introduce our speaker. So Lisa Fine from the History Department here at Michigan State, who've actually done a lot of work on auto, has done a variety of interesting things, including a history of the Rio workers here in Lansing, work on UAW members and hunting, and coming out of some of, I believe, her archival work on the hunting issue, she encountered the real story of how the construction workers and the auto workers in southeastern Michigan ended up in a fairly interesting kind of drawn battle over the issue of nuclear power and the Enrico Fermi plant in Detroit. So Lisa will be coming here to do that presentation on April 13th. Feel free to take a flyer and give one to friends and family. Our last one of the year, Paul Laurie, will be coming in from the History Department at the University of Toronto. And his presentation in April is called Doing Time in the White Man's Army, African Americans and Penal Labor in the American Military, 1917-19. So I think you'll find that to be of interest. And please feel free to pass those on. Auto-related and also sponsored by us, at the MSU Museum, at the MSU Library on March 27th, Ben Hamper, famous for the memoir Rivethead, will be in the library talking about that experience of being on the line in Flint, and also about writing Rivethead. So feel free to come see Ben Hamper on March 27th. That's a nighttime lecture. Today's talk is co-sponsored by Motor Cities, the Automobile National Heritage Area. And Motor Cities, for any of you, if you Google that as one word, Motor Cities, you'll find their very interesting website. It's a division of the National Park Service based in, for the most part, southeastern Michigan, really looking at the history of automobiles, auto barons, auto workers, and auto communities. So you might want to go there. And while you're in the museum, remember that we currently have two things that are related that we're running. Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives has an exhibit called On Equal Terms, which is on the main floor, which is about the experience of women in skilled trades and construction. And it's really quite an interesting exhibit if you haven't had a chance to see it. That's open until the middle of May. But about to come down fairly quickly is the painting that's right outside the door of that exhibit, which is our painting that's called The Iron Men by Mark Priest. And that's on exhibit downstairs. So check those exhibits out if you would while you're here. So let me get to the main enchilada of the day. Jeff Rothstein is a professor in the Department of Sociology over at Grand Valley State University and finished the revisions on his book on the topic that you're about to hear about just earlier this week. That book has been accepted by Cornell University Press and will be going in the direction of print. Those of us who are dinosaurs, remember, we like books, you know, so we'll be happy when Jeff's book is out. But Jeff and I, when we met, ended up talking about his research, and one of my colleagues elsewhere said that this is perhaps the best title for a talk he's heard in a long time. So let me introduce Jeff, and please welcome him to the MSU Museum, where he's going to be doing the presentation Where Good Jobs Go Bad, Globalization, Deunionization, and Declining Labor Standards in the North American Auto Industry. Jeff Rothstein.
Thanks, John. Now I feel like I'm under a lot of pressure because I have the best title of a talk. Let me start out with just a tidy little story about how this research sort of got started. About 20 years ago, I was working for an organization called the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers, and I got involved in their part of the campaign to fight NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And I was in Washington, and I was discussing with these guys, and those of you who remember will remember that there was a lot of talk about whether or not we were going to gain or lose like 100,000 jobs, and Ross Perot was talking about a great sucking sound. And I made a comment to somebody, 100,000 jobs in the size of our economy isn't very many. We really should be talking about what's going to happen to work, to the way we work. And somebody looked at me and they said, well, we can't fit that on a bumper sticker. So a few months later, they had the Gingrich Revolution, and I decided to go to grad school. Oh, is it on? And what is it possible to turn off like this light? It might be easier to see.
Okay, there you go.
Okay, thanks. Okay. Am I doing this right? Which button do I press?
Okay, tell you what, I will be your finger over here.
Oh.
Okay. It matches my skill set.
All right. So, very often, So as I was saying, when I approach this as a study. I went to graduate school and I wanted to look at labor in the global economy. And I was fortunate enough to find a group of faculty there with similar interests, and we had a labor in the global economy research circle. And one of the things that becomes apparent is when you start talking about labor in the global economy, people all automatically start thinking about sweatshops and low-wage work and stuff like that. And I wanted to look at something a little bit different. Like I said, I wanted to look at the impact on work, perhaps in jobs that aren't so mobile. So it's not about who, where they're going, but what's going on. So the auto industry, unlike jobs in sweatshops, which have always been bad jobs, that's why they call them sweatshops, the auto industry has always been associated with good jobs. Okay, these are the jobs that brought us a blue-collar middle class. Okay, in industrialized countries like our own, and even in developing countries, for a long time in the 20th century, and I would argue to this day, building an auto industry was seen as a form of economic development. You were going to provide good jobs to people. And in fact, that's still if you think about it, that's still the case now. As much as our economy has changed, if you're an auto company and you announce that you want to open an auto plant, you get policymakers who otherwise believe in neoliberalism scurrying to offer you all kinds of incentives to bring the auto plant to your location, right? And then you will get workers lining up, potential workers lining up around the block for an opportunity to work in your auto plant. So we've got these jobs that, before globalization, if you will, in the mid-20th century, they were considered good jobs. And now here we are, and we're in a global economy, and they're still considered the good jobs. So it seems like an opportunity to see, so what's happened to the good jobs, to understand the impact of globalization. Okay, so here's the question. What has happened to what remain among the best jobs in the global economy as unions have been weakened, wages and benefits have declined? I'm giving away the conclusion here just in case anybody has to leave, and so that you'll know what I'm coming around to towards the end. We've seen declines in wages and benefits, and we've seen the pace of work intensify on the assembly line, hence my title, When Good Jobs Go Bad. And okay, so my conclusion is that even the best jobs are getting worse. The problem that we have in terms of labor in the global economy is bigger than a bunch of sweatshops, and there's a need for enforceable international labor standards to shore up the labor within national industrial relations systems. Okay? In looking at the auto industry, and I realize that when I talk about the North American auto industry, as you're going to see, I'm talking about all of North America, including Mexico. Why look at how am I going to look at the auto industry? So there's an approach to studying globalization called the value chains approach. And basically, the value chains approach says that we can study globalization, we can see what happens by looking at particular industries and looking at the way they change with processes of globalization. And to look then at the way those value chains touch down in different locations. Okay? The obvious way that people sometimes see this is if you think about what we know about sweatshops, and if you think about sweatshop demonstrations and students against sweatshops, there's an understanding there of the value chain, that there's a relationship between the retailers and these faraway factories that they don't actually own. And by understanding that value chain, that's what allows people to understand that if they want those workers in those factories in faraway places to have better jobs, they need to pressure the retailers or the universities that license the Spartan stuff or whatever. Okay? Now, what frequently doesn't happen when people talk about value chains is, well, frequently they don't talk about labor specifically, but also they don't talk about the fact that when these chains touch down in different countries have different national industrial relations systems, which Dunlop told us a long time ago involve management and labor and government operating within some web of rules. And it's these national systems and the way they operate within the web of rules that result in the fact that we have different sort of character to our labor relations in different places. It's what helps us understand why the French are always going on strike and we're not. Okay? So what globalization does, as I'm going to try to demonstrate, is that there's a reweaving of that web of rules, and it's done in particular ways that weaken labor. Okay, so what I'm going to do is talk to you about three auto plants that I say the field work was done at different times between 2001 and 2007. And if anybody's really interested in my methodology, we can talk about that later. But there's some important things that made these good points of comparison to me. The first was they were all building GM's full-size SUVs. And this was back when these things were just selling like hotcakes. And they were all operating the same lean production system that GM was starting to implement at all its plants that GM called its global manufacturing system. The first plant was in the state of Guanajuato, Mexico, in a city called Silao. And this was your quintessential greenfield site. So the plant was opened in 1994. It was immaculately clean. Okay? The workers there were all, few exceptions, they told me they were experimenting with women, but they were overwhelmingly male. They were in their mid-20s. They all went to work wearing identical uniforms of black jeans, blue GM polo shirts with the GM embroidered logo and black boots. They worked in teams that rotated their jobs throughout the day. They had systems for contributing to quality in the plant. And when they were not working, they could go dine in the communal dining room that this place had. This place was just adorned with all these motivational posters. There was one with a picture of a pouncing lion encouraging workers to help GM become king of the automotive jungle. And there was another one with a picture of children's smiling faces, and it said, si se puede, papa, right? Which for those of you who might know anything about Latin American social movements, it was a strange appropriation of that term. And this whole plant had been built in the early 90s. It opened in 1994. It replaced a plant in Toluca, Mexico, closer to Mexico City, which is the Mexican traditional industrial heartland. It was built for the purpose of producing automobiles for the United States in an area that was previously known primarily for the quality of its strawberries. Okay.
What were they assembling here?
They were assembling, if I remember correctly, I've got in a chart later, but I think Chevy Suburbans, they made the they made the Chevy Avalanche as well, which was, they don't make that anymore, but yeah. The second plant was located in Janesville, Wisconsin, and they also made Chevy Suburbans and the Yukon and some other. This was GM's oldest plant in North America until they shut it in 2008. This plant dated to a 1913 Samson tractor factory, which GM had bought Samson tractor. They stopped making Samson tractors. Their technological wizardry was that Samson tractors were steered with reins instead of a steering wheel because it was felt that farmers would be more comfortable with that. Over the years, GM had expanded the plant tremendously. They had bought up a lot of the surrounding property, knocked down all the buildings, paved them as parking lots. There was one holdout. Jim Zacco owned Zacco's Bar and would not sell. It gave the plant the appearance that they had a bar in the middle of their parking lot. And this was no small thing because a plant of this age, they every once in a while, reporters would come around looking for a storyline. And it was always about, look at this old, outdated place. They have a bar in their parking lot. So when I showed up and started researching, one of the things I was told in the bar was that I was welcome to hang out and talk to people, but if I took out a recorder or a camera, they would shoot me. I took that seriously and didn't, but I could be found at times in the bathroom scribbling some quote that somebody just told me that I couldn't forget. Okay, the third plant is in Arlington, Texas. And in Arlington, Texas, the plant was from the 1950s. It had been built at a time when Arlington, Texas was a small farming community between Fort Worth and Dallas. The plant had been built with the anticipation that if the U.S. again went to wartime production, they might have to make airplanes there. So it had extremely high ceilings, which by the time I was there, it allowed them to introduce miles of conveyors into the plant, which allowed them to reduce the number of material handlers they had working there. And, go on. So we have these three plants. And I'm looking at these plants as three different examples of where this commodity chain has touched down. Okay? There's a tendency when we look at plants like this. In fact, I had somebody on my committee who wanted me to write, my dissertation committee, wanted me to write about Silao and Janesville as sort of the old, outdated plant being replaced by the new plant. But the plants coexisted for 14 years. And they offer an opportunity for me to compare and contrast different experiences of globalization as well as the common trajectories. Okay. So when I talk about the globalization of the North American industry, North American auto industry, You got to remember that until the early 1980s, we basically had mutually exclusive auto industries in North America. The U.S. and Mexican auto industries did not trade with one another, though they had common automakers. Okay? So you had GM and Ford and Chrysler producing automobiles in Mexico strictly for the Mexican market. All of them were practicing mass production that was sort of introduced and revolutionized the industry by Henry Ford. And they all had strong unions. So in Mexico, you had a system of corporatism, right? Their national industrial relations system was based on corporatism, and it worked like this because they were practicing what's called import substitution industrialization that protected the domestic market. So since the domestic market was protected, the automakers were sort of guaranteed a profit. And then the government intervened with the unions to convince the automakers, look, we're protecting your market. You need to pass along some of the benefits of this to your workers in terms of wages and benefits. And in exchange, the workers and the unions will continue to support us, the ruling party, in our somewhat undemocratic rule of the country. And that's the way corporatism worked. And through this mechanism, auto workers in Mexico became a blue-collar elite, among a few blue-collar elites in other protected industries. In the U.S., we had a very different industrial relations system, where the government basically is more laissez-faire, sort of sets itself up as the referee, right, in the fight between management of labor and labor. But in the auto industry, what we had was industry-wide pattern bargaining. There were basically three automakers. They all negotiated the same contract with the UAW, and that took labor out of competition. And what we saw over the years was increasing wages, increasing benefits, and the auto workers in the United States becoming a blue-collar aristocracy. Okay. This starts changing in the 1980s. Okay. There's three aspects of globalization of this industry. The first one is we had the integration of the U.S., Canadian, and Mexican auto industry. The U.S. and Canadian actually merged together in the 1960s, but then Mexico joined. So we integrate these mutually exclusive industries into one continent-wide North American auto industry. And this started in the 1980s as Mexico abandoned import substitution industrialization. They start looking to export. Ultimately, they join NAFTA and were fully integrated. Another aspect is that, as we all know by now, we have far more automakers in the United States than we used to. Right? So first we had import penetration from the Japanese and the Europeans, and now the Koreans, and no doubt the Chinese will be here soon. And these automakers not only sell cars in the United States, they now build cars in the United States. Okay? There, when they came, particularly Toyota introduced lean production. And lean production is, I'm going to talk about it in terms of how it works on the shop floor, but lean production is also a whole philosophy about how the business should be run. Okay, so mass production, the general concept was that the automakers would seek to own and make all the plants and make their own parts. Right? They wanted to be very big. Lean production, Toyota's concept was, we don't want to make spark plugs. We just want to design the cars, sell the cars, and do final assembly. This business model has not only swept the auto industry, right? Lean, everything now wants to be lean. This led to a complete shakeup of the auto industry. So it's de-verticalized, right? And so we saw GM and Ford take all their parts plants, form new companies, and spin them off as Delphi and Visteon, right? so that they could then go bankrupt claiming that the labor costs were too high, okay? Which, of course, was completely foreseen, and somebody could argue that it was a way of slashing labor costs. But it also involves the reorganization of work on the shop floor, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. Okay. In Mexico, once they abandon import substitution industrialization to produce cars for export, this breaks up the system of industrial relations that they have, because the employers turn to the government and they say, okay, well, you're not guaranteeing us a market anymore, so we need concessions from the workers. Right? We're paying them too much. They have too much control over the shop floor for us to be internationally competitive. The government basically agrees and uses that same relationship that they have with the unions to get the union leadership to make the concessions in what they call PACs or pactos. What happens on the shop floor is that suddenly, once the workers are no longer being seen as sort of a blue-collar elite and they're having to make concessions, they start demanding democracy within their unions that they didn't have before, and we're more willing to overlook. Okay? The automakers, in response to this militancy and to be closer to the market, because once they're producing for export, we're the export, right? They're going to send cars to the United States. They start moving north, okay, to greenfield sites like in Silao, where there's no history of industry, and they can sort of start afresh in greenfield sites, just like automakers in the United States have done in the South. Okay? So, to give you an example of how this works, GM arrived in Silao, and they handpicked a union, which is called CITIM. Now, CITIM is not what we call a sindicato blanco, okay? Which some people might have heard the term or understand that in Mexico, it frequently happens that employers recognize a union that is a sindicato blanco. They call a ghost union. Okay, so nobody in the plant, none of the workers know they have a union, but if they start to want to organize one, then the company says, you already have a union, and look, here's your contract. Okay. CITIM was not a sindicato blanco, and the first thing they told me when I met them, literally the first things out of their mouths were, we are not corrupt. You know, they said, you want to see? You're welcome to come hang out with us whenever you want. Which is, if you're a dissertator doing research, is about the best thing anybody can ever say to you. Right? So, but they espouse a philosophy of union management cooperation. Right? Like this one guy who told me, I love my wife, I love my daughter, I love General Motors, and I love my union, and I see no contradiction in any of that. They cede all control over the shop floor. Okay. There's no grievance procedure. There are no union reps on the shop floor. In reality, they have little bargaining power over GM, as one of them said to me, well, GM is GM. Okay. They also allow GM to coordinate labor relations among its local suppliers. So they divide up the local labor force by gender and by educational level. And then they established a wage hierarchy among the plants with GM at the top so that GM would have the most attractive employment. And anybody visiting this plant would never suggest that it was a sweatshop. What the union does a lot of is they provide services to the workers, many of whom, in fact, by design, none of them have any history working in a factory. GM won't hire anybody with any experience, because they want to teach them how it's done. These workers very often need help acclimating to having a steady income, to being away from their families for a whole workday. Okay? They don't go home for the traditional family dinner at 2 o'clock in the afternoon anymore. And the union does all kinds of things to help them. They help them open bank accounts. They help them apply for mortgages that they can get. They can get low-wage mortgages now that they, low-rate mortgages, or they could. I don't know if they still can. And they provide all kind of services. So this is probably difficult for you to read, but what happened was once GM, and this is part of the way the value chain in the auto industry now works. Okay, when somebody sets down a plant, they immediately invite their suppliers to come and join them. So what happened is once GM came down, all these other plants, many of which you'll notice are former subsidiaries of GM. So you've got American Axle, you've got Lear Seating, you've got Delphi plants. And what they've done is they've set it up so that there's a wage hierarchy between them, and they divide up the labor force, and that helps them keep wages low. Because there's no pressure. So one HR manager at one of the plants complained to me that he had a high turnover problem, and he wanted to solve it by raising wages, but he wasn't allowed to do that because his wages weren't allowed to approach the guy across the street. Okay, so what we've seen in Mexico then is over time is we've seen the auto industry shift north, where the workers are less militant, the unions believe in labor management cooperation, wages are stifled, and they've basically ceded control of the shop floor. In the United States, of course, we had a different dynamic. Okay, the foreign automakers come in and open transplants, which cuts into the Detroit automakers' market share. It cuts union density because all these transplants, or most of them, almost all of them, operate non-union, and the UAW is unable to organize them, and we can debate if anybody wants to about exactly why that is, but let's just say they're not able to at this point. Okay? Initially, this actually doesn't have a tremendous impact on wages and benefits, because the strategy by which Toyota and Honda, when they come to the United States, decide to stay non-union is to match the wages in the UAW contracts. Okay, over time, this strategy has gone by the wayside. As the automakers became more aware of the fact that in the United States, it's very easy to prevent people from organizing unions, and you don't have to pay the UAW rate. So now, for instance, Toyota recently opened a plant in Texas where the starting wage was about $15 an hour. Volkswagen just is opening one in Tennessee. They're advertising $15 an hour. And there's Mercedes plants and, you know, all these plants in Alabama and Mississippi. And they've given up on the wage parity thing. Okay? So eventually, this means that the UAW, the union density is declining, and the cost of labor is now a source of competition again. And eventually, we get to the point in 2007 where the UAW contract establishes a second tier, okay? Entry-level workers, so that earn half as much as as the senior workers on the assembly line. Just so happens half as much is just about the starting wage at some of those plants I just mentioned. And incredibly limited benefits, and the automakers are allowed to have up to 20% of their workforce in this tier two, and immediately we see a new round of buyouts so that the automakers can shed their expensive workers and hire the younger ones. Okay. What's actually happening is that for years, we know this is a union density in the United States. And we know that for years, union density in the United States has been declining. And for years, the UAW members were relatively immune to this. Right? In fact, we saw more and more auto workers had a bigger and bigger wage premium over other blue-collar workers. What happens when these transplants come in is the UAW and the auto workers are suddenly becoming exposed, okay, to what has been going on in industrial relations in the United States. Okay? So what we've got now in both the U.S. and Mexico is globalization, declining wages, declining benefits in both countries. Something else starts happening. I told you that in Mexico, the union cedes control over the shop floor. Way before 2007, when the UAW negotiated a second tier of wages, we had seen concession bargaining throughout the auto industry at the local level. It's at the local level where local unions negotiate the work rules in the plants. And as what we saw happening was a process that became known as whipsawing. Okay? Because the Detroit automakers, as they're losing market share, are discovering they have overcapacity. Right? They're going to shut plants. They use the opportunity to shut plants to force local unions into a competition with each other to keep their plants open. Okay? So what do you have to give back? You have to give back workplace rights. Got to modify seniority systems. Okay? You have to give back work rules. And perhaps even more important, you have to give back your rhetoric. And what you start seeing in the auto industry is local union presidents talking about how wonderful they get along with management. Okay? Because if you don't, you risk having your plant close. And when your plant closes, your members wind up chasing these jobs because these are still the best jobs that they can get all around the country, and they join what in GM became an army of what are called GM gypsies, okay? Which are people who basically their plants have closed and they've moved to other plants around the country, and it's very convenient for GM because they then become a permanent symbol to their coworkers of what can happen if you don't get along with management. In Janesville, this started happening in the 1980s. Okay? In the 1980s, the Janesville plant was threatened when GM opened a plant in Fort Wayne, Indiana, to build the pickup trucks that were being built in Janesville. And GM wasn't sure if they were going to keep Janesville open, but they gave workers an opportunity to transfer. So about 1,500 workers left Janesville and moved to Fort Wayne, Indiana. But Janesville was still operating, so they hired a whole bunch of local temporary workers. Okay? By the time I was there, those temporary workers had over 15 years seniority. Because they didn't close the plant, okay? And that what GM had done was burnished in the memory of workers there. And these workers who were hired were known as the 86ers because they were hired in 1986. And to some people, the goddamn 86ers, okay? After they go to, once this Fort Wayne thing happens, the union starts freaking out that the plant could close and making all kinds of concessions. Okay? Until in 1991, there's at the cutting edge, according to GM, in terms of labor management cooperation. And GM is now trying to implement its first understanding of lean production, or Toyota Japanese production. And They completely renegotiate their contract. They're doing everything right. And GM awards them the Chevy Suburban product line that had been built in Flint, Michigan, and about 3 weeks before they awarded it to them, the folks in Flint, in a panic, renegotiated their contract. But it was too late. So GM awarded it to Janesville and at the same time praised Flint for their actions and suggested that hopefully there's another product coming down the line for them. Okay? In Arlington, a similar thing happened in the mid-'80s. There was a product line that they didn't get, and they all started panicking, and they renegotiated their contract. And then by 1992, some of you will remember that there used to be a GM plant in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Right? The plant in Ypsilanti made the same product as the plant in Arlington, big full-size cars. GM announced that in 2 months, they would make a decision which plant was going to close. And the competition was on. Okay? The folks in Texas, the governor got involved, the local community got involved, they gave up everything they could think of to keep GM, and the plant in Ypsilanti wound up. Did you have your hand up? Oh, I thought I saw something. Okay. So that's the whipsaw by which the automakers have then, in the United States, taken back control over the shop floor. Okay. So what we have is lower wages and benefits in both places. But here's the thing, okay, about lean production. At least in academic circles, though I've been told by the union brothers and sisters that this doesn't fly there, there's a story about lean production that it's actually beneficial for workers. It makes work more enjoyable. It makes work easier. Okay? If that's the case, if there's greater productivity and it makes work easier and more enjoyable, you've got a win-win situation. Right? In which case, this Satim-style union in Mexico is sort of legitimated. And the non-union transplants practicing, Fred Barnes, the conservative commentator, when GM was going through its bankruptcy, he wrote that the transplants practice something he calls progressive anti-unionism, because what their anti-unionism does is allow the implementation of lean production that makes work better for workers. So they're better off without a union. And even the whipsaw in GM plants could be seen as some sort of necessary evil, because ultimately it makes, okay? Because if work is easier and more enjoyable, then you could argue globalization has been a wash. Right? You get lower pay, but more enjoyable and easier work. Okay? All right. Okay. And this is basically an argument that was going on in academia in the 1990s. The people who were the lean enthusiasts say, look, lean production rejects Taylor's separation of the conception and execution of work. It creates an intellectual challenge for the workers. They're happier, they enjoy it, and it enhances job quality. Okay? Critics saw in lean production, that whole thing about cutting the fat, that would actually mean intensified work. Okay? Now, this debate was in the 1990s, but it actually has continued in our popular rhetoric to this day. I was reading all this stuff around the time of the GM bankruptcy, and they were debating about whether or not to loan GM money, and all this stuff about work rules was coming up. Okay. So I took a look and compared the way these three plants were operating their global manufacturing system to try to understand what's going on. The global manufacturing system is basically the Toyota manufacturing system that GM learned from Toyota at their joint venture called NUMMI in Fremont, California. And that includes four components widely seen as part of different lean production processes. First, you've got the strict standardization of work. But you've got workers organized into teams with team leaders. That's supposed to make work more fun. You've got Andon systems that allow workers to stop the production line so that they can have their say if something's going wrong. And you have all kinds of ways for employees to provide management with their ideas. Okay. The emphasis on this plan, in all the plans that I studied, was the standardization of work towards 55 seconds of work for each minute. The other components were actually all designed to reinforce that standardization of work. Okay. Here's what I mean by standardization of work, because people don't really often understand exactly how standardized we're talking. Okay? This is what a manager in Arlington told me. Every job that we have in this facility, there is a standardized listing of every element of that job and the specific sequence that you're supposed to perform that job in and the amount of time that's allotted to do that job, and we have that level of detail for every job that is out there. Standardized work just basically says, here is how you do this job, and you do this job this way every time. We know it takes 4 seconds to do this, 12 seconds to walk and pick this up, 8 seconds to shoot that screw, 4 seconds to put that label on. Now you can dispute whether or not the time is right. That's fine. If you think there's an issue that we have not assigned the appropriate amount of time, we'll send an industrial engineer out there with a stopwatch and a clipboard and validate it.
How on earth did you get that quotation?
I asked him. Oh, no, in the bar I couldn't tape. I had a tape recorder on when I was talking to this guy. Yeah, this guy wouldn't set foot in the bar that the workers were in. Don't worry. So the interesting thing is the three plants were operating completely different global manufacturing systems, aside from the fact that they all had this 55-second benchmark for work. Workers in Mexico were working in teams and rotating their jobs, and they had a system for pulling the cord, and they go through a seven diamond system to figure out what the problem was, and all the workers would converge and they'd figure it out. This only took a few seconds because what they were really talking about was things like, hey, are you putting the right part on? Are you using the right tool? That type of thing. The employee participation, they had lots of input from workers for changes that should be made to the standardized process. Okay? And they would post these on bulletin boards and give workers awards for making them and stuff. Okay? In Janesville, at the other end of the scale, it was completely superficial. Workers were officially organized into teams, but it was like in gym class when they make you count off. Okay? It was just consecutive people on the assembly line. You're a team. Right? Because they needed to report to Detroit, we have teams. Okay? And they'd have a team leader. The team leader's job was basically to give people a break if they needed to go to the bathroom. And they didn't pull their andon cords if they saw a problem, because they said some supervisor would come up running over and scream in their face, "Don't shut me down. Don't stop assembly, because we need to keep getting the cars out the door." And the place in Arlington was kind of interesting. It was somewhere in between. They'd sort of settled into a compromise where the teams actually did function more on an informal basis. It had to do with with differences in the seniority system. They had a seniority system based on teams, and it kept the team sort of stable. They had team leaders that really did stuff. And the team leaders would respond to the andon cords. Okay. Now, in terms of whether or not this made work interesting or enjoyable, the responses I got when I asked workers were, it's boring, repetitive, monotonous, and mind-numbing. Nobody ever suggested that their job was the least bit intellectually challenging. Okay. Instead, workers in the U.S. who had been through the change talked about the intensification of work. Okay, they said the assembly line is a hard way to make a living. The mental stress due to the monotony is bad enough, but the repetitive motion of bending the same all day is worse. Or every day that you work in that plant, you're going to run a marathon. Okay, one guy got really angry talking about it. He said to me, "Have you factored in there?" He's talking about the industrial engineers, "that I might need a drink of water? Have you factored in that I might need to tie my shoe?" And other people said, hey, they set up all the job for right-handed people. If in fact, so we know that the work has become more intensified. The question, though, is it really, what's at the heart of the lean production process? Is all this teamwork and participation necessary for the production process itself? It's supposed to make things more productive and result in better quality. So, well, it turns out that according to J.D. Power, the three plants in my study were all producing cars of equal quality, which really, when you think about it, isn't that much of a surprise, because don't we all know that the quality of an automobile is engineered in? Productivity is a little bit more difficult. Productivity is measured in hours per vehicle. How many hours does it take to labor hours to produce a vehicle? The numbers here are a little bit this would suggest that Arlington is more productive than Janesville, more productive than Silao. But there are differences between the plants that make it difficult to compare hours per vehicle directly. So what I do is I look at the hours per vehicle over time for the period they were making the same vehicles, and it turns out that the Janesville plant is cutting its hours per vehicle at the same rates as the other plants, even without the teamwork, even without the participation, even without the Andon systems. Okay. So what the comparison shows is that lean production, first of all, there's no doubt, talk to auto workers, it intensifies work. Okay, that intensification of work is at the heart of lean production. The idea is to get more work out of each worker for each minute worked and to have as few workers as humanly possible. That's cutting the fat. So lean production actually increases, here's the irony, it actually increases the need for union representation on the shop floor. Okay, in the mass production system, the system itself created buffers because things weren't terribly efficient. Okay, they couldn't operate at 55 seconds out of the minute. Okay, through the whipsaw and through the types of unions they have in Mexico, they've managed to remove labor from the shop, any effective role on the shop floor, and speed up production, when under lean production, what the workers actually need is more union representation and actually somebody to negotiate the rate of movement of work. Okay, but the UAW has actually has abandoned criticisms of lean production. In fact, when Ron Gettelfinger testified before Congress, when GM needed its bailout, after advertising that there's no union wage premium, he informed Congress that union negotiated work rules cannot be blamed for the current problems facing the Detroit-based companies. According to the Harbor Reports, the industry benchmark, union-represented workers are actually more efficient than their counterparts at non-union auto plants. Okay? I mean, what we're basically seeing is at the very top of the UAW, the effect of the whipsaw, so that the union leadership is now advertising there's no union wage premium and we're just productive. I couldn't remember, at the time I remember thinking, the people in the organizing department must be loving this, right? Like, come join the UAW where you don't get more wages and working conditions aren't any better. Okay, so the moral of the story is that globalization has weakened labor across the North American auto industry. In Mexico, directly through this government intervention within their national industrial relations system. In the US, by exposing workers to labor's decline that went on for the whole second half of the 20th century. As a result, we see lower wages and benefits and an intensification of work, yet auto work remains among the best blue-collar jobs available. Even the best jobs in the economy are getting worse. So when we talk about labor in the global economy, we need to frame it broadly. It goes well beyond the sweatshop problem. And that means that we need a solution that's going to be sort of a a long-term, holistic solution. I argue we need enforceable international labor standards to shore up labor's bargaining power within our unique national industrial relations systems. Okay? Sort of corporate campaigns and the type of stuff that's done to and sweatshops actually circumvent the whole idea about national industrial relations systems. They just try to get, you know, corporations to fix things. Okay? The ILO has established a core set of labor rights, right, which are basically to address the worst problems the global economy has to offer, but has sort of given up on its other 189 different regulations that have been passed. And we can't have agreements like the North American Agreement for Labor Cooperation, which was the labor side agreement to NAFTA, which was based on the idea that we're all going to cooperate, that we should all actually enforce our labor law. Okay, and I guess I'll leave it there and take any questions or comments you might have. Well, it's sort of a heartbreaking question because hopefully at the end of 40 minutes of talking you would know that. But what I'd like you to take away from this talk is that globalization compromises labor within national industrial relations systems. And if we're going to address labor in the global economy, we need a holistic approach that includes enforceable international labor standards. Would you like me to say that again slowly?
Jeff, let me hit you with an easier one, perhaps, that doesn't force you to go back over everything you said, which is to say, talk about Canada, since Canada didn't end up in your thing, and North America does include that big nation.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I'm going to have to admit to having not done any research in Canada. So I only have my sort of general idea about what's gone on, which is that the Canadian auto workers have not fared much better than the auto workers in the United States. While there's no strict pattern bargaining, they don't have the problem with health insurance, of course, because they're Canadian and have a sane healthcare system. But, you know, without a doubt, lean production, you know, that whole thing, that has gone industry-wide. So they're absolutely subject to the same problems there. I don't know the details of their, I don't even know whether, you guys might know, do they have a two-tier wage system in there? No? Okay, so then they're probably not faring quite as bad. And if I looked into their system, we could probably see why that is. I have to admit to having not done that at this point.
One reason is when GM asked for two-tier, they occupied headquarters in Canada and wouldn't come out, so GM took it off the table.
Okay. Well, The comment was that the reason things are better in Canada is that when GM suggested two-tier, the workers went out and occupied their headquarters in Canada. And, you know, that actually does get back to the differences between our national industrial relations systems, okay, because we have basically given up effective form of protest within the labor movement in the United States, with few exceptions. So you might get arrested or fined if you did that in the United States, and nobody wants that to happen. Right? Yes, sir.
I'd like to take up your challenge.
Uh-oh.
That you put out in your need to frame issues of labor and globalization broadly. You mentioned neoliberalism once. I don't think it's going to be nearly enough to get better ILO standards. range of things that culminate in wage reductions. I don't think we answer this question without getting at hours behind decisions to run sustained balance of payments deficits, decisions to manipulate exchange rates all over the place.
You're talking about a full-fledged counter-hegemonic movement against neoliberalism.
That's exactly okay. Because the model has collapsed.
Let me respond to that for a minute.
In terms of the residual power structures.
I agree with you. Okay. I mean, look, to get an enforceable, set of international labor standards like I'm talking about, that's not going to happen anytime in the near future. You are going to need some sort of counter-hegemonic movement. There's a very specific reason I don't frame this in terms of neoliberalism. And I think that labor and people who want a different system than we have are making a big mistake when we call it neoliberalism. Because we do not live in a global economy that is neoliberal, okay? If there are way too many things going on in the economy that violate the basic tenets of neoliberalism, including the bailout of Wall Street, okay? The bailout of GM, okay? We buy loads of goods from China, which people complain doesn't float their currency. And moreover, if you look at labor in China, the people working in those factories are migrant workers in China who do not have a free labor market. Okay? There's no free trade. There's no free market. What we're talking about in the global economy that needs to be overcome, perhaps through a counter-hegemonic movement, is a business agenda. Okay, and for labor, right? The business agenda is inherently anti-labor. So it's fine not to have free labor markets in China, where not having free labor markets keeps wages lower, right? But in the United States, we should have them because we don't want unions, right? By the business agenda, as long as we're cutting labor costs, it's good. And I think that if, there's a lot, when we start looking at the global economy as neoliberal, then you can come up with a laundry list of all the hypocrisy. When you start looking at it as a business agenda, right, put in place by businesses with powerful political influences, suddenly the contradictions disappear and it all makes sense. So that's why I don't talk about neoliberalism, because I know somebody's going to ask me about it and then I'm going to go off on my thing about neoliberalism. I don't really see it changing measurably. In Mexico. It's surprisingly, it didn't change measurably in Mexico when they voted Dupré out and brought in Vicente Fox. Okay? Because now the idea of corporatism, the corporatist system, has sort of, I don't want to say collapsed, but it's sort of gone to a system whereby the official unions know what they need to do to get you've got a system where corporations, right, the firms are recognizing the unions before they've even hired any workers, right? So the unions know, even unions with good intentions, okay? The guys that I spoke to at Citim, I really think their hearts were in the right place, but you're talking about a system that's corrupted, even if they might not be. Okay, so that the way a union grows is to be attractive to the firms, not the workers. Okay, and I don't think that that's gonna change. Now, incidentally, I'd say that the union in Silao was far better than some of the Sindicato Blancos that we see, in the maquilas and stuff like that.
So over to Neil and down to Amy, and then we'll see what
Please.
To make a suggestion, and that is they're incredibly fat. It is a giant union which has lost memberships over a long period of time, which finds itself in 2012 with money in the bank, with lots of money. A strike funder, which I will go, and now in charge of the health care. And there is very little motivation for them to go out and recruit. I'm throwing that out as a how would you respond to that?
Well, to go out and recruit workers? Is that what you're saying? So,
or to take up even their cause other than in just some kind of peripheral.
I know some folks from the UAW here who would probably agree with you. I don't know.
At the top.
You know, it's complicated. Put it that way. But there's no doubt the UAW finds itself between a rock and a hard place. Okay, so I think that there are fair criticisms about, you know, why haven't they organized the transplants? Okay, but I don't know how many people here have ever actually been on organizing campaigns in the United States in the last 20, 30 years, but I have, and it's not really very easy to organize workers. So to say, well, why don't they dedicate the resources? And I mean, it's not that simple. Are they run perfectly well? You know, there's always the iron law of oligarchy. You know.
Well, starting from the last question, I mean, I don't have any doubt that Bob King understands that power of the union stems from the density of the representation of the industry and wants to organize. Problem is, how is that done? I'm not sure that the strategy coming forward, we're going to have corporate campaigns to put pressure on globalized companies to support unionization is going to be a winning strategy. But at the same time that he's pro-organizing, he's also accepting of lean manufacturing. So really, the question there is, how do you go to somebody at a non-union plant and say, join us because we can negotiate lower wages for you. We can negotiate lower wages to help make sure that your jobs aren't threatened.
I mean, I heard something. I thought that I heard him talking about the fact that he was now campaigning simply to he was trying to convince some of the automakers, the transplant automakers, that they should recognize the UAW because there were some benefits for them, right? Which means that now if that's your line, then you're obviously not going to come out and say, you know, and we'll make sure that the workers aren't, you know, overworked on the assembly line. I mean, yeah. I don't think that this can be fixed, right, until we actually do something about the way our industrial relations systems work and workers actually regain the right to organize and strike and whatever. You're dying to say something.
Up here. Quick question about the lean production plants that you visited. Was there like a specific system that they, like a 5S or a 6 Sigma, you know, like which method to use production that they used?
They weren't calling it anything that other people were. Okay, so they were calling it the global manufacturing system. They talked about having their footprints. Okay, they had things like their 7-diamond process for decision making. I'm not sure, but like I said, you know, if you like one guy said to me, well, it's really just the Toyota manufacturing system, but to put some ownership in it, we call it the global manufacturing system or GMS.
Point I was trying to make before.
Sorry.
Is that the issue is there struggle with that?
Yeah.
And if you look at even in the periods where you identified the union making concessions, in the 80s, for example, the union made concessions. They were generally made on a local level, but that was because when you force your plant is threatened, your opportunities on a local level, you can't fight that. Okay. You can only make concessions. The only way to fight that is for a union-wide response to it. And when the international won't respond to individual threats of posing, then locals are forced to go on their own. Now, in the late 80s, there was a fight back against that through the organization of New Directions, and it was quite successful in posing an alternative strategy for how places could fight with different tools, looking at implant strategies rather than strikes, things which took advantage of what lean manufacturing did. That is, as you narrowed your supply chain, as you tried to go into more just-in-time delivery of parts, and you have lots of opportunities to destroy the success of that if you're creative and you're able to organize that. So, for example, Pontiac Truck and Coach led much of that fight here in the southeastern Michigan area in the late 80s. That plant's now closed. I mean, part of the problem that's gone on is that the ability of the companies to move their investment elsewhere has endangered where people can fight. I led the fight in 2007 against the two-tier contract. I was chairman of the National Negotiating Committee at Chrysler. Our negotiating committee made it clear to Gelfinger we would not accept that. I believe that's why they went to GM first. When they came to Chrysler, we voted down that contract twice before finally people realized that on the bargaining committee that our voting it down was not going to change the minds of the international, that it needed to be a different strategy. But clearly there are forces in the union today that want to see a fight against the lean manufacturing and the acceptance of lean manufacturing, but we've not succeeded on the national level.
Look, there's plenty of strategies for fighting. The problem is, when you've got a great strategy for fighting that can be successful and the automaker is looking to cut 10 plants anyway, well, fine. Be successful fighting. I'll close your plant. I mean, when I was down in Arlington, they told me that there was like 100 different. They said we have 100 different locals represented here because they had become the place that GM gypsies were going. I heard people arguing, saying, we should fight. And somebody looked at me and said, yeah, but they closed your plan. I don't want to move.
You can look at it. You can have that in every different way. We were forced in 2004 to sit down with them. They told us they had no product. They had just negotiated an agreement in Toledo. They have body and paint and chassis outsourced to other companies. That was the model that they wanted to go to. They said they wanted that model in our plant. We told them to close the plant, that we were not going to follow that model, and they backed off. So a lot of what's going on is simply the company is taking advantage of the weakness of the union situation to get as much as they can.
Yeah.
But, I mean, obviously you're right. If you only have sales to support 10 plants, you're not going to have, you're never going to negotiate for them to have more than 10 plants.
Let me make one quick, first of all, let's give another round of applause to Jeff.
Thanks.
Building vengeance. Well, they are
Thanks a lot.